About 10 years ago, I was really lucky to have my friend Gail Guy say, you know, there's this really great American poet who's going to be teaching a class in Ligonier, and we should just go out there and sitting on this workshop, and you know, Gail was a sort of a really advanced poet, and I was a little baby newbie poet, just starting to write a few poems here in Pittsburgh. This is about 2000. And the great American poet who was leading the workshop was Ed Ochester. And he very kindly looked at some of our poems and in front of everybody went through my long, interminable poem about China and went, and he said, oh, there might be something here. And he said, what are these adverbs? And I was so lucky because I was just starting out, and he said this other thing. He said, you know, you don't really have to do an MFA in poetry. I mean, I think he was addressing people of my age, you know, who might, you know, he said, you really ought to read this book called Claims for Poetry by Donald Hall. And almost everything you really need to know is at least presented there in a way you might, you know, you might get something out of that. So Gail drove me home, and I went out and got Donald Hall's book, Claims for Poetry. I read every bit of it, and I cannot tell you how great that all was. And I cannot tell you how thrilled I am to have Ed Ochester reading here tonight. He is, years before I was even beginning to do poetry, seriously, I had found a book called The Pittsburgh Book of Contemporary American Poetry, which he edited with Peter Essick. And I started sort of stumbling around and found some of his other books. And he has this wonderful new book out, Unreconstructed Poems Selected and New. He was he led the writing program at Pitt from 1978 to 1998. He was twice elected president of the Associated Writing Program. He is a great Pittsburgh resource, a great American resource in poetry. He's a great poet. We are so lucky to be here tonight. Please welcome Ed Ochester.
Okay, thank you. It's really great to be here tonight with Jan and Stacy and so many other people I know. I was surprised earlier by Jim Hall coming over. I haven't seen him for years, and it's great all of a sudden to make those acquaintances again. And it's wonderful in this room to be here. Everything wonderful except the heat. But we'll live through it, I guess. I wanted to say, after this great opening performances by Stacy and Jan, I've decided I've got to be in my best behavior. I can't beat them at that stuff, but I'm not gonna try. But I'm gonna read one poem from this book, and everything else is pretty well new, including a poem that was written a couple of days ago. Let me see. Okay, I'm gonna start with a poem called My First Brazier. My friend Judith is asking her class to write poems titled My First Brazier or Condom, and says that she'll write a poem herself on the subject, though I'm not going to write a poem praising braziers, and I'm not going to write one about having a persona of braziers because I wasn't one, and I'm not gotta be a fetishist like Marion Moore wearing a three-cornered brassiere. I mean, that's just too obscure. I mean, I just wear brassieres. But as she speaks, I think of my own embarrassment and nervousness with such things. Not brassieres particularly, but how the rocking motion of the Myrtle Avenue bus as I stood and bounced to school, left me in a state of such excitation that I worried it would be perceptible to some sweet ancient sitting 6 inches from my crotch. And before that, how doing jumping jacks in sixth grade had given me an enormous, I thought, erection, so that I was led to try strapping the offending member to my leg with rubber bands. And isn't that smart? With all the little red rings around it, like the tail of a bald and embarrassed raccoon. And later in college once, an ill-advised move I made caused a condom to fly off me like an exhausted birthday balloon. So that it flew through the room with the erratic motion natural to deflating latex projectiles and actually stuck to the wall. And after that, when I imagined I had learned as much as there was to know about sex, I had to find excuses when Ellen at 4 p.m. ran up the stairs wearing only an old raccoon coat and a pair of sneakers, because I was probably an idiot, but I was writing my honors thesis on Wallace Stevens and didn't wish to be disturbed. I'm sorry for nothing, and I've learned so much from my mistakes that I could repeat each one with pleasure. And I'd also say that sex has taught me two things. Don't judge, but if you must judge, forgive. And let me say, I'm really happy, if you like the poems, of course, and I'm really happy when you clap, but I'd like to ask you, if you would, to clap as much as you like at the end. But I'll just read some poems for a while without any clapping, okay? Okay, this is one called Steel City, a little epigraph. Change is the great subject of poetry. And speed, I would add. I envy the poets of New York, so many weird people to see and shops to name, restaurants in which to meet other poets and complain about overpriced borscht. And I'm a New Yorker by birth, living in exile, not like Catullus, who was bitter about it, but in a city that boasts the original hot dog shop, the secret of its great fries, molten lard. Not too far from a real carousel with real little kids screaming for joy. Not too far from where Maz hit the home run that beat the hated Yankees in 1960. And that not too far from a conservatory with its statue of Bobby Burns standing next to a plow, whose handle, when viewed from a certain angle, looks remarkably like a giant crooked penis extending from Bobby Burns' knickers. A fact that has always allowed me to make jokes about the physiology of Scotsmen, who may be the only ethnic group not subject to PC constraints, perhaps because of antipathy to Andrew Carnegie, the evil Scot, who screwed the workers and gave them a library, as well as layers of black grime for all their buildings, as well as their lungs, a coating still black as priests on the older structures, as now teenagers make out on park benches after eating lard-infused fries, and little kids on the carousel yell, more, more, to their sagging parents as endless automobiles circle looking to park, and a flotilla of balloons, red, white, yellow, and green this afternoon, floats toward the Empyrean. Powder blue above the clouds scudding before the tireless winds. This is a poem from a couple of days ago, whose title is July 16th. Stephen Colt tells me that hambone is Barrel House Blues slang for penis and is also used as a verb. Aaron Copland is at least as important to classical music as Hambone Willie Newbourne to the blues. And one March, I was sitting in a cabin at McDowell at the piano where Copland had hamboned Appalachian Spring and was very pleased to be in his spectral presence as I one-fingered Yankee Doodle on the Baby Grand, and a New England blizzard was dropping 2 feet of snow. And out of loneliness and creative impotence, I wondered how I was ever going to get a poem out of this. Diner, Beatles on the Juke. Listening to the Beatles sing Money Can't Buy Me Love is like listening to Mother Teresa sing Love for Sale, or T.S. Eliot doing I've Gotta Be Me. And the Greek waiter here, who's not as young as he used to be either, is a dead ringer for the aging Bob Dylan, right down to black string tie, black vest, and 40s pencil line mustache. Strange what forms vanity takes, but probably because love's in the air. I remember Rick Wozwo saying a very long time ago, I'd like to make love to 1,000 women. Like, fat chance, Rick, we said then. And now a little kid runs up and down the aisles and stumbles to a front of a large woman. His mother, evidently, waddles up to comfort him, and a very pretty young woman in low riders also bends down to wipe his tears as Bob Dylan smiles appreciatively at her ass, above the crack of which is revealed the inevitable tattoo, which seems to be a cartoon chipmunk. Hotel California is not playing as I leave and back out my car, worried about a red Chevy very close to my rear, but some guy yells, don't worry, you got plenty of room, plenty of room. And I do. I think he may be a good omen for us all. I used to be very secretive about my love life, which compared to Rick's ambition was only mezzo-mezzo. But I can tell you that as a young guy, my guiding principle was never hang out with anyone who thinks chipmunks are cute. Dialectic. There's a little epigraph from David Lehman, a wonderful poet, friend from New York. Dialectic. The epigraph is, in college, the first theme you had to write was on the American dream. It'd be great to live in a free enterprise society instead of a monopoly capitalism society. Didn't Teddy Roosevelt bust up the trusts? Now the rich guys give the senators copies of laws they want passed. When I lived in Madison, a city named after a president most historians think was an atheist, but Republicans will tell you was the father of a Christian republic, we rented an apartment for $70 a month from an elderly farmer who had a photo of Teddy R. tacked to his kitchen wall. I thought then the farmer was a reactionary. Now he'd be a flaming radical. Today I'm watering marigolds in July with the temperature in the 90s, and a wren is singing his heart out. Talk about free enterprise. He's got 3 or 4 nests inside half an acre, something to really crow about, though unlike roosters and various demagogues, wrens, of course, don't crow. This is a poem called The Death of Hemingway. I heard the radio report as I drove with my girlfriend to breakfast at a place in Cambridge Square that was very fashionable for omelets that year. I should back off a little bit and say there are several quotations from Hemingway that are embodied in the text. I won't do anything other than just go like that, I guess, when I come to this. I heard the radio report as I drove with my girlfriend to breakfast at a place in Cambridge Square that was very fashionable for omelets that year. When we came back to Paris, it was clear and cold and lovely. We couldn't believe he had killed himself, not with a shotgun. What a way of saying fuck you to his friends, the ones who would have to clean it up. We ate our omelets and drove out to the Cape. My fantasy that year was that the sun at Truro was so strong you could hold your hand up to it and see bones through the flesh. Willie Callahan, who boxed with him, quoted Hemingway, "They always praise you for the worst aspects of your work. It never fails." Callahan's foreign book, That Summer in Paris, is out of print in America, and no one I mention it to has ever heard of it. A few years ago, a young novelist I like said, "No one really admires Hemingway anymore." And it's true. The time has done a job on him and his macho poses. We swam and danced a lot that summer on the Cape. "We were always lucky," I said, and like a fool, I did not knock on wood. I dated one of the Walker girls, and at the Art Center's costume ball, we won first prize from Abe Burrows, who wrote the book for Guys and Dolls and was famous long ago. Though this poem isn't about nostalgia, wherever or whomever you are, time will change it. Sometimes there's nothing there, or nothing left. "Nada," he said. "Nada." For a number of years, I've lived northeast of Pittsburgh on a back road in Armstrong County, and have enjoyed that. And this is a poem that comes out of that experience. It's called September Rain. Old house, I remember children's laughter and tears. Then and now, the spruces bend under the rain. The red maple we planted last spring has survived the summer's drought. The garden is ready for snow. I spent much of my life walking a few acres between two unnamed hills. I shouldn't brag, I know. So many people don't know where they live. Let me end with two poems that are relatively recent. This poem for Britt, the person to whom I am married, was composed on December 16th, which is Beethoven's birthday. And the poem goes, "Beethoven is such a great composer, but his personality is questionable, which shows once again that one is what one does. Music, poems, even money have claims, but also such unremarked acts as feeding sparrows in winter, which God doesn't do too well, though we're told he notes the fall of every one. So that as I park the car, your sparrows in the snow-covered forsythia greet the weak sun with a matrix of cheeping, dozens of them, not from gratitude, but perhaps from overflowing joy." And this is the last poem I'll read. This was, again, one of a number of poems that over the years I've written in reaction to music, rock music or folk or classical. This is called Goldberg Variations. It was written after listening to a wonderful pianist, a Canadian named Angela Hewitt, play Bach's Goldberg Variations. Instead of writing the speech I have to deliver next week, I'm listening to the music Bach wrote for his student, Johann Goldberg, who was employed by an insomniac count who wanted music through his long nights, don't we all? And I wonder what the Nazis did with this piece. They couldn't disappear the Urmeister of German music the way they did poor Mendelssohn. Perhaps they renamed it the Goebbels Variations, the bastards, which illustrates how a great culture can sour in the blink of an eye, or auf Deutsch ein Augenblick, perhaps even ours one day. But enough sadness. How lovable is the endless invention of Bach, who must have loved Goldberg, to expend such energy and grace on this music, even though he was given a little casket of golden coins in payment by the Count, Bach the ever practical. And now I've come to the 31st variation in the aria, the end, and must try to emulate him who was so disciplined in his art, and who perhaps, after chatting happily with young Goldberg, sighed for a moment, then said, "Back to work."